From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fremont.
Pacifica, California.
Pleasanton.
Oh. From Vallejo.
Me from Antioch.
Coming up, we see whether robots make good caregivers.
The robots are reliable. The robots are trustworthy. We don't have to worry that the robots are going to get burned out, stressed out.
Then the possible dangers of new robotic technology.
We're going to have to get accustomed to the idea that these intelligent, flexible, robotic machines are going to be making life and death decisions by themselves on the spot without human intervention.
And we see how robots are giving one person a new sense of independence.
It's so powerful, and that freedom to go places that you normally wouldn't be able to go or to do something for yourself.
Rise of the robots, today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. It wasn't long ago that living with robots was just a futuristic fantasy.
Oh, boy, can Rosie play basketball? Come on, Rosie, show me your hook shot.
Okay, here it goes.
Wow, right in the basket.
Now it's a reality. There are robots that do everything from lifting disabled people out of the bed to lifting the spirits of the depressed. There are robotic chairs that give you hugs, robotic vacuums that clean your floors, robots that tell stories to your kids at night. But not everyone thinks that artificial intelligence is the best thing, even if it does benefit them in some way. Last week, world-renowned physicist Stephen Hawking, who's paralyzed and uses a highly developed voice recognition program, expressed some serious concerns.
The development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. Once humans develop artificial intelligence, it would take off on its own and redesign itself at an ever-increasing rate. Humans, who are limited by slow biological evolution, couldn't compete and would be superseded.
That's a pretty dark perspective, but it's not one shared by Silicon Valley artificial intelligence expert Jerry Kaplan.
People's ideas of what these things are come out of the media. They're mostly robots running amok. Most of the science fiction stories that involve artificial intelligence or robots are dystopian. And they're really not looking at what the benefits of these systems are going to be or how it's going to the potential positive impact of these on society.
Kaplan is an entrepreneur and Stanford lecturer, and he says those impacts are coming soon because advances in robotic technology are moving more quickly than ever before.
Mostly they're going to be capable of doing tasks that currently require either human effort or human attention.
That was artificial intelligence expert Jerry Kaplan. We'll hear more from him later in the show. But now we're going to take a closer look at one robot in particular that's already being used in several countries. It's an animatronic baby harp seal named Paro. It's cute and it's smart. It has sensors, microphones, and cameras that help it respond to sound and touch. And it was designed to help people with dementia. But behind its fluffy white exterior lie ethical concerns that may become more common as robots make their way further into our daily lives. KALW's Angela Johnston has the story.
At the Livermore Veterans Hospital, there are a few animals residents can see. Wild turkeys that run around the grounds, rattlesnakes that hide out in the dry grass, therapy dogs that make weekly visits. But there's one animal in particular that Bryce Lee is always happy to see, a baby harp seal. Now, this seal isn't alive. It's a robot called Paro that was invented in Japan. But Lee doesn't necessarily know that as he pets it. He and the other senior patients here have dementia or similar conditions. Paro the seal was designed to comfort them. It's a type of tool known by scientists as a care bot.
She's happy today.
Oh, yeah. She's quite a little animal.
Lee is interacting with Paro under the supervision of Cassandra Stevenson, a recreation therapist here at the VA hospital. They're in a rec room surrounded by other residents. Because of his condition, Lee doesn't speak much, but Stevenson gets him to talk by asking him questions about the seal.
What else do you think she eats?
More fish.
More fish. I would too if I was a seal, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be handy.
It would be handy. You think she catches them herself?
I don't know. Not her, no.
No. Why not?
Paro is pretty adorable. It has big black eyes that open and close and follow your movements. It's about the size of a large cat, and when you pick it up, it's heavier than you'd expect. It weighs exactly 6 pounds, so it feels like you're holding a newborn baby. It charges by sucking on an electric pacifier. I wasn't expecting it, but Paro immediately drew me in.
Yeah, that's really cute.
It's also quite complex. Behind its fuzzy white exterior, the seal has sensors that detect touch, sound, light, heat, and movement. And it reacts in different ways.
We started using it with the residents, and a lot of them think it's real. They'll bark at it, they'll pet it. We had one resident who used to sing to it all the time.
That's Kathy Craig, another therapist at the VA. Craig thinks it's a useful tool for residents who are antisocial, agitated, or sad. She pronounces the robot's name Paro.
We'll bring out the Paro robot and set it down, and they'll start talking to the Paro. They'll talk to other people. It'll brighten their mood. And if they're maybe at a risk of wandering and getting lost, they'll, instead of that happening, they might sit down with Paro for a while and spend some time with it.
Craig says they're even doing a study on whether seal time can replace anti-anxiety medication. Nursing and therapy staff have also noticed Paro brings out a sense of nurturing and caring in patients.
Oh, she's winking at you. Look at that.
Yeah, she did.
Wow, she must really like you today, right?
You don't visit that often.
Yeah, no, that's a rare thing. She's flirting with you.
Yeah, she is.
And she is.
In addition to Paro, live dog therapy is also available for the residents at the VA. A few times a month, volunteers come with their dogs and let the veterans play with them. Their interactions are very similar to when they play with Paro. In fact, the little white dog Bailey that visits frequently is the same size and color as Paro the seal.
Want to come say hi? Look, come say hi.
Veteran Bob Mountain is also a resident at the VA.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
This is Bailey.
Hi, Bailey.
His mood changes immediately when he starts to pet Bailey. Dr. Jeffrey Lane is the psychologist who introduced Paro to the Livermore VA 3 years ago. He says watching a particularly difficult patient interact with live therapy dogs was the reason he brought the robot to the hospital in the first place.
She was screaming and yelling a heck of a lot most of the time. Medications weren't working, and all the other things as staff were doing weren't working. But one thing I did notice is that when the dogs were brought into her room, that's when she stopped.
But as useful as they are, Lane says real animals present some problems. They're unpredictable. They can transmit disease. And most importantly, they go home at the end of the day.
So I thought to myself, is there some way we could bring animals into her room and kind of leave them there? Wouldn't that be great? For practical reasons, we can't do that with live animals. So I went to the computer, you know, fired up the old Google machine, and found an article on a blog about the Paro.
Dr. Lane thinks there isn't much of a difference if a resident plays with Bailey or Paro. He says humans are wired for connection.
People are able to connect with this robot. I mean, it's designed to behave in a way and interact with the person so that you want to touch it, you want to pet it, you want to interact with it.
But not everyone is on the same page as Dr. Lane. Shannon Valor is a philosophy professor and a virtue ethicist at Santa Clara University. She studies the way our habits influence the development of our moral character. And she thinks there are a few ethical issues to worry about when using care bots like Paro.
People have demonstrated a remarkable ability to transfer their psychological expectations of other people's thoughts, emotions, feelings to robots.
Nurses and therapists at the Livermore VA don't explicitly tell the patients Paro the seal is a robot. They play along with questions about where it lives, what type of fish it eats.
Are we deceiving them? Are we setting them up to be deceived? And is this dishonest of us to encourage?
And there's another problem. It has to do with us, the people who are actually doing the caring.
So my question is, what happens to us? What happens to our moral character and our virtues in a world where we increasingly have more and more opportunities to transfer our responsibilities for caring for others to robots, and where the quality of those robots increasingly encourages us to feel more comfortable with doing this, to feel less guilty about it, to feel, in fact, maybe like that's the best way that we can care for our loved ones.
Valor says that caring is really hard, even for people with the best intentions.
The robots are reliable. The robots are trustworthy. We don't have to worry that the robots are going to get burned out, stressed out, that they're going to lose their patience. And we have to worry about that with human caregivers.
So Valor says she doesn't deny the potential usefulness of care bots, but thinks we should be wary of our intentions when we design them.
How could we help you take better care? Not how could we do what you're doing, not how could we replace you, but how could we help you become a better caregiver?
That means making robots that might challenge us, ones that make us work to form a relationship and encourage conversations with others.
What kind of a seal is she?
A white seal.
A white seal? Yeah.
That's all I can do with it.
She's pretty domesticated, right? She's house trained.
Yeah.
Back at the Livermore VA, Bryce Lee is talking to therapist Cassandra Stevenson about Paro.
That's what seals usually eat, right?
Yeah.
The wild ones do, yeah, that's right.
Paro could be an example of the middle ground that ethicist Shannon Valor spoke of. It's helping therapists like Stevenson do her job better. It's getting patients like Lee outside of their room to socialize. But by not getting in the way of human-to-human interaction, it could help us develop our caring responsibilities rather than deplete them. At the Livermore VA, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
To see pictures of Paro the Seal, go to our website, kalw.org, click on Cross Currents. As we heard in that last story, care bots like Paro the Seal can bring up some thorny ethical issues for the humans who create and use them. Author, entrepreneur, and computer scientist Jerry Kaplan has been thinking about these issues for the last 30 years. He teaches the history and philosophy of artificial intelligence at Stanford, where he's a fellow at the Center for Legal Informatics. KALW's Jen Sheehan spoke with him recently about care bots and other new advances in intelligent robotics.
So the kinds of robots we're seeing today are much more responsive and interactive than we've seen in the past. Things like care bots, like Paro the Seal, for example. What do you see as some of the major ethical questions of this new robotic technology?
Well, this is a very complex issue. It is certainly true that there are many dangers in what I might call gratuitous anthropomorphism, but there are many advantages too. In the example of the robotic seal, it provides great comfort to the Alzheimer's patients, and that's a good thing. But to the extent that it's doing so by fooling them or misleading them, you could take the point of view that that's a bad thing. It's a mixed bag. If we're building machines that tug on your heartstrings in order to persuade you to do things which are not in your interest, obviously, that's a bad thing. If we build robots that provide comfort or care and do so in a, what I might call, a socially honest way, I think that's a good thing. So this is a great example of an area where we need to be aware of both the advantages and the dangers and educate people about them so we can draw a line between technologies that we think are on the positive side of the ledger and others that are on the negative side of the ledger. Another example is the issue of robotic prostitutes. It's going to be a very big area. I don't mean necessarily that you can go to a robotic brothel at the moment, not that I'm aware of, but there are several such Android-like devices or entities that are under development in a number of different places. Like any new technology, we need to understand, regulate, and manage how these things are introduced and used in society. On the positive side, if you're replacing live prostitutes, let's assume they're female for a minute, it reduces exploitation of women. It may reduce the transmission of disease. Those are two very positive things. On the negative side, if it's like most things, if it's abused or used excessively, it can cause people to withdraw from normal relationships with other people, which we would consider healthy, and to transfer either the desire to be around other people or the connection to other people onto a machine in an emotionally inappropriate way. I bring that up because most people aren't thinking about prostitution as an area that is going to be severely impacted by automation.
But that's a labor market just like any other labor market. What other industries are you looking at that are going to be seeing these kinds of rapid changes going forward?
One of the first areas of what I might call flexible robotics or flexible automation that people are already getting comfortable with because they know it's coming is autonomous cars. So there are positives and there are negatives. The positives are benefits to society are outstanding. They are tremendous. And people really have not begun to understand what it's going to mean for those kinds of vehicles to be available. But we need to also deal with some very, very difficult ethical issues that these kinds of devices will raise. For example, suppose your autonomous car is driving down the street and it, through no fault of its own, despite its best efforts, gets into a situation where it's going to have to hit another car very hard, very fast, get into a very serious accident. And there are two cars, and the one thing it can do is decide which car to hit. Well, is it okay for the car to make a decision saying, well, that car's got three people in it, and this car's only got two people in it, so I'm going to hit the one with two people? Now, we are going to have to get accustomed to the idea that these intelligent, flexible, robotic machines are going to be making life and death decisions by themselves on the spot without human intervention. And that's just with one technology that's going to be here within the next 10 years. And you'll be hearing a lot about what kind of ethical principles do we want to put in it. Let me give you another one. Imagine that in a hospital you have a intelligent system that is responsible for maintaining power to all kinds of life-saving machines in the hospital. Okay, well, the major power goes out, the generator comes on, we have an earthquake here in San Francisco, and it's projected that the power will not come on for another 48 hours, and we have 12 hours worth of power if we power the entire hospital. Now, we can do stupid things and dumb things, like go for 12 hours, let it run out, and everybody who's on a life-saving machine dies. Or we may be able to do something more intelligent, like, well, this patient can have their oxygen cut back by 50%, and that one can't, and this one is going to be dead in 48 hours anyway, but that one's got a chance to survive. And whether we like it or not, the best utilitarian outcome may be to have a machine assess all of these and make real-time adjustments and changes in whose machines are going to be turned off and which are going to be powered. Now, that's a very disturbing thought to think we would let a machine do it. On the other hand, the alternative may be much worse, which is, okay, we don't like that, so we're going to kill everybody. So we have to face up to the difficult kinds of decisions that these new technologies are going to pose and recognize that in many cases, we're going to have to embed directly into the device or the system the moral and ethical principles that we agree on as a society we would like that system to adhere to.
Well, given these kinds of changes that are coming to different areas of society, do you think this is something that's being dealt with adequately by thinkers, by policymakers? Are we moving quickly enough to keep up with our own technological advances?
Not even conceivably close. I think that mostly we've got our head in the sand about a lot of these artificial intelligence technologies. A recent study at Oxford said that 47% of the professions, of the major professions, will be subject to automation over the next 10 to 20 years. So a lot of this stuff is going to change. Again, unfortunately, it's not a this is good or this is bad kind of thing. We really just need to be aware of what are the positives, what are the negatives, and where is this whole thing going.
That was Jerry Kaplan. He teaches artificial intelligence at Stanford University. He spoke with KALW's Jen Chien. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Here in the middle of the Bay Area's innovation hub, robots seem to be everywhere. And for 53-year-old Henry Evans, they're helping him do things he thought he'd never do again, like shave his beard, get a beer from the fridge, feed his dog, or visit his kids at college. 12 years ago, a serious stroke left Evans paralyzed and unable to speak. Yet, from his bed in the foothills of the peninsula, he's busy developing and testing robots designed to help people with disabilities do more. Evans calls his technology Robots for Humanity. KALW's Angela Johnston has his story.
Henry Evans and his wife Jane live high up in the Los Altos foothills. To get here, you have to drive up twisting roads with steep switchback turns. On a Thursday morning 12 years ago, Henry drove up these same roads after dropping his children off at school.
We had a very busy life, raising four kids. My husband was a CFO for a startup company.
That's Jane Evans, Henry's wife.
And then my husband suffered what they call a brainstem dissection. It's a very rare type of stroke, but it left him completely paralyzed and mute. And as Henry described to me, he woke up and felt like he was cemented in his body, literally cemented.
That stroke left him trapped, unable to lift a finger at first or say a word. But now, with help from technology, Henry feels free. Today, he meets me in the driveway using a robot called the Beam.
Welcome, Angela. Come on in.
The Beam is basically a big computer monitor with a webcam attached to a small base by two poles. Henry's face fills the screen. Henry's controlling the robot from a computer in his bedroom. He has an eye tracker on his glasses that acts as a cursor, and he has just enough movement in one of his hands to click a mouse. A message on the screen reads, "Follow me." So I do.
Angela, I'm so impressed. You're right on time.
Jane opens the door for us, leads us down a narrow hallway past family photos and a shelf of homemade wine. The Beam rolls behind us until we reach Henry's room. He's sitting up in bed, grinning. A lot has changed since Henry's stroke.
My day starts with my caregiver, which is often my wife, emptying my catheter bag, brushing my teeth, feeding me breakfast, and giving me a shower.
That's Henry, talking to me with a text-to-voice program on his computer. He types his responses using his head tracker, slowly moving his head up and down, side to side, sliding the cursor over a digital keyboard. Henry and his family had to find a new way to communicate, and this is one of them. But right after his stroke, he couldn't move his head, so at first they talked using blinks.
One blink was yes, two blinks were no. And little by little, we would divide the alphabet.
But they still talked about everything.
he rated the nurses in the hospital, who was his top choice, second choice, third choice, and why somebody was at the bottom of the list.
When Henry gained more movement in his eyes and head, they began to use a letterboard, a clear plastic square with letters grouped together in threes and fours.
T, it's, S. So if he was looking at ABC, you can guess the letter A and he'll shake his head no if you're wrong.
This is still the primary way that Henry and Jane communicate in person. They've become so good at it, Jane doesn't even need a board anymore. She can just picture the letters floating in midair. They call it virtual board. Jane shows me how it works by telling Henry to ask me a question.
Henry, you want to do virtual board? Okay, ready? Go ahead, look at a letter. W, H, A, what? J, no. L, K, I, kind, of. C, A, R, what kind of car do you have?
Subaru.
Watching them work together is amazing. It's like an ultra-fast game of Jeopardy or Hangman. But not everyone can use the virtual board, and that's where technology comes in. Henry uses his text-to-voice machine to talk with friends. He types dozens of emails and Facebook posts daily with his head tracker.
The best part of the day is getting on the computer, because in cyberspace, everyone is on equal terms.
This is the motivation for Henry's work, to help people with disabilities become more independent, more equal. The robots and machines he's developed, invented, and tested are simple. He's worked on everything from a laser pointer head switch that can turn the lights on and off, to a bed that he can move up and down, to drones that he can fly around his backyard, inspecting his solar panels or the grapes he and his wife are growing behind the house.
So tell me about the first time you were able to fly a drone outside. What was that like?
The first time I flew a drone outside, I felt a combination of amazement, freedom, independence, and enjoyment. And then I crashed.
Henry also has a pretty good sense of humor. He works on his ideas, called Robots for Humanity, with friends, family, professors, and scientists around the country. The biggest collaboration was with a now-defunct robotics lab in Menlo Park, robotics researchers at Georgia Tech, and their robot called the PR2. Henry first saw it on CNN one day.
I wanted to show you what some of these robots can actually do. I'm joined now by Charlie Kemp.
The robot grabs a bottle of pills and hands it to the reporter.
Wow.
And I immediately imagined using it as a body surrogate.
A body surrogate. That means Henry could control the robot to do things he can't. When the lab disbanded, the PR2 moved in with Henry and Jane. It'll be living with them for the next 5 years. During that time, the Georgia Tech researchers will test how it can work with caregivers and help people with disabilities.
Yeah, I'd love to see the PR2.
Let's go see it.
Yeah.
Henry follows us down the hall on the beam to his son's bedroom, where the PR2 lives when the researchers aren't working on it.
So that's the robot right there. That's it. It's about 400 pounds. Big guy.
It's white and silver with metal arms coated in a soft, gray, skin-like material. And it has a strong, muscular torso. The two cameras on its short, swiveling head look like big black eyes. It looks friendly. Jane says Amber the dog sleeps next to the PR2. And I did feel like I was meeting another one of the Evans pets. And when you shake its two-pronged hand, it moves just like a human's.
Wow, its movement is so fluid.
You can hear the noise even. And it's got joints, like where our wrist is, our elbow is, you know.
In the Evans household, this robot has delivered Halloween candy to kids, taken pizza from a delivery guy, gotten beer from the fridge. The researchers are teaching the robot how to feed Henry yogurt. And Henry has used it to do something he hadn't done since before his stroke.
He's clicking on buttons, making the hand get closer and closer to his face until it's about an inch in front of his nose.
That's Steve Cousins, one of the original creators of the PR2.
And then he reaches forward and scratches his itch on his nose. And everybody in the room like let out this sigh of like, wow, he just scratched his nose for the first time in 10 years. I mean, it was just an amazing thing.
It might not seem like a big deal, but a little bit of autonomy can go a long way.
The really cool thing about Robots for Humanity is it shows how even if you're in the most extreme situation, you can't talk, you can't move, you still might be able to use a robot and influence the world. And as Henry's doing, go visit the world.
Even though Henry feels like he's trapped in his own body, with technology and his mind, he can go anywhere he wants. Into labs to talk to people who are helping him invent things, or to art galleries around the world.
I am currently involved in numerous ongoing projects with researchers from almost a dozen universities. The one project I will talk about is the World Tour of Museums for Quadriplegics that I am organizing.
A virtual world tour of museums for quadriplegics. Jane Evans says this independence is priceless.
And I really truly believe that is why Henry is so healthy today, is because his mind is active. He's soaring. He's soaring.
Do you want to go to Rhode Island now?
Well, I wish I could travel.
At first, I was confused by this question. But before I can ask, we're off. Moving around inside a robotics lab at Brown University, Henry leading the way. In Los Altos and Rhode Island, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
Now enough hearing from us, we want to hear from you. Email us at news@kalw.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW, or call us 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Tom.
The Cross Currents team includes Sandhya Dirks, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hambrick, Chris Hoff.
Hello, Hal, do you read me?
Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Mack, Marlo McKenzie.
Hello, Hal, do you read me?
Ted Muldoon, Colin Peden.
Do you read me, Hal?
Judy Silber and Stephen Short.
Do you read me, Hal?
Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Leela Day.
Affirmative Day. I read you.
Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. The theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
And these musical voices are members of the San Francisco Girls Chorus. They'll perform their annual holiday celebration in song this Friday night at the Old First Church in San Francisco. The concert begins at 8 o'clock, and there will be some sing-alongs. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.